What's the rumpus? No, seriously, what is the rumpus? Jackie and I are joined by guest Daryl Haynes, and we watch the movie Miller's Crossing, the Coen Brothers gangster epic. JFIO presents.
What? Are you kidding? We got us a family here.
This ain't no coon, huh?
Okay, I'm not gonna sit here and debate.
I'll show you the life of a man!
You will find a fortune. Good would not be the fortune you seek.
I suppose you think you're raised hell.
When I've raised hell, you'll know it.
Something is very wrong. I don't want Santana Abraxas. I've just been in a terrible auto accident.
What's the most you ever lost in the coin toss?
Sometimes knowledge is precious. Accept the mystery. A Coen Brothers podcast.
Yeah, welcome Ooh. Back to Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast, where we go through every single Coen Brothers movie in absurd, ridiculous, line-by-line, excruciating detail. Sitting across from me is the sick twist called Jackie Lechtold Say.
Did I say sick twist?
I did call you a sick twist. Wait, hey hold on, wait. I actually have a theme song for you today.
Oh,
so
cool.
You can get pumped up.
Oh, I needed this. It's morning, you guys.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get up. But I think I just woke up.
Jackie's jam.
Thank you.
We are recording this Hello. Early on a Saturday.
Bam.
Bam.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. And sitting to my left is an actor, a comedian, a writer, improviser, podcaster, Daryl Haynes.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you for the welcome. I feel so...
Like, warmly welcomed.
Warmly welcomed. I didn't want to just say I feel so welcomed because I felt like that would be like repetitive. Like, and I'm hitting the table. I shouldn't do that.
You know what?
Okay. They can't tell.
This is a warm environment. I like to keep it warm and friendly. It's like a fireside.
It's like 85. It's like 85 degrees in here. You know, I see the thermometer over there. It says 85 degrees.
You don't want to make it a hot environment because then it's a hot
house.
It's
like Bikram yoga. Or is that the hot one?
Is that...
Might be.
The one that you... Yeah.
We should have a Bikram podcast.
That would be miserable. We're just going to talk about how hot we are the entire time.
No, I think you would bring out everybody's true self.
Is that what... Have you ever done hot yoga?
No, I just imagine that would happen.
I don't think... Because I don't think my hot self is me when I'm sweating to my pores and I can barely communicate with people.
When I'm sweating, I'm not saying anything. I'm just like... I don't want to be sweating anymore. I need to recover.
Maybe. Right. No, it's like my brain is shutting down. That's what that is.
So yeah. It's like your reptilian self.
By what self? Reptilian.
I can see it as like your
survival mode.
Yeah. Instincts. Yeah. Instincts is like, yeah, you don't think about anything. Like that's what's great about like after running, you don't think about like your life. You're just like, whoa, that was hard. Yeah, you just exist.
No,
exactly.
I feel like I'm like a computer server. Like I operate at 100% capacity in a slightly cooled room. I like 65 degrees. That's perfect. Mm. If I'm a little bit chilly, then I'm on edge.
Oh yeah, you do like air conditioning. I've noticed that.
I do like my AC, and that's really bad actually right now because California's going through a drought and it's a hot summer, and I shouldn't be wasting electricity constantly cranking AC. Well, I should just get used to the heat.
Mm.
Welcome to the world. You should.
I should. I should just live out in the world, in the hot world that we are creating with our carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no need to get political here. We're talking about a period piece anyway, from the time before global warming, where people just drove gas guzzlers and nobody cared.
Mm-hmm.
But before we do that, we need to get to know our guest a little bit better.
Yeah.
With a segment we call Inside Daryl Haynes.
That's a whole segment.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Oh, no.
This is the segment, Daryl, where we ask you questions inspired by the movie of the day.
Okay. Oh, boy. I feel like there's a lot of pressure.
No pressure. Zero pressure.
Okay.
All right. No pressure.
The only pressure is to answer honestly.
Okay.
And we'll know if you're lying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Jackie is a human lie detector.
Yeah.
Like, you're like Tim Roth in that show. Lie to me.
I don't watch that.
Whatever.
I saw an episode.
In this film, the main character, Tom Reagan, gets badly beaten up at many occasions throughout. Have you ever been in a fight?
Not since I was like 8th grade, maybe. But I started taking Krav Maga and boxing classes.
I saw that on your website. I saw Krav Maga training. I was like, okay, shit. You know, you might know a little bit something about.
I mean, I'm not a big deal by any.
You're a big deal in this room.
No, you could probably take both of us on if we decided to come at you simultaneously.
Well, maybe you. No offense, I'm really strong. Yeah, you've seen me arm wrestle.
But that's not Krav Maga. Yeah, you start arm wrestling this guy, and he'll like snatch your eye out. Is that Krav Maga?
Snatch my eye out.
Yeah, I mean,
isn't it? You're gonna say that was.
Yeah, like if you're, like if I ever got in a fight, I wouldn't do that. But like if it was like you had a knife or something, and you're trying, then I would.
Like if I was arm wrestling, grab my eye.
Yeah, no, but you could, like you poke at eyes and stuff. Like that's a thing. Instead of punching, like sometimes like. Clawing is better.
Doing, I feel like if I was winning at arm wrestling, you would not poke my eyes out.
But that's okay. But we got to imagine a different scenario where like you're encountering somebody who says full on, "I'm going to kill you."
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I'm going to like I've got a knife to your throat and I'm arm wrestling you with the other hand. And then what are you going to do?
Then
you got to go for the eyes.
Yeah. Then I'm going to go for the eyes. if you were a guy, I would kick you in the groin. But that wouldn't work. Like, there's a lot of groin. There's a lot of groin kicks, and Krav Maga has a lot of boom.
And I appreciate that. I appreciate that it's not necessarily about clean fighting. It's about going for what works.
It is. It's whatever will take a person down. You know. And I know that is how you arm wrestle. You do always have a knife when you're arm wrestling.
You've seen one of her like viral arm wrestling videos going around the internet.
Yeah. Oh yeah, 33,000 views to the video.
It's true. It's like one of those like bum fight videos, except
we're not bums. We're like awesome people, but yeah.
No,
I feel like that could be a thing. Like it just like has an opening of a street fight, but then it just turns into arm wrestling. It's like it's
right. You got like, people going around like, "Oh no, you did not do that!"
Yeah.
fight.
Okay. I've never been in a real fight. Jackie, I assume you've never been in a real fight.
False. I have been sort of in a fight.
Have you really?
Ooh. Well, I was in second grade, and I consider this a fight because. There was this boy, and I was like, second grade. He like took my friend's pencil, and I was like, "Give it back." And he was like, "No." And I was like, "Give it back." And I think I pushed him or something, and he socked me in the face. I was like, second grade is like what, eight years old, 7 years old? There was blood everywhere, like all over my hands. It was really horrible. And then I have a bump on my nose since then. Or because I got older and I'm Jewish and I got a bump, but it could be either.
But you're assuming it's because of something that happened to you in second grade that just never went away.
Yeah.
It's a battle scar.
Well, because my mom doesn't have like a Jewish nose and I didn't before. And then after I got
punched, I had a little bump in my nose.
Yeah. But see, I didn't have that before I got punched. But sometimes when you get older, you get it anyway. But I mean, there was blood everywhere. So
your nose never stops growing your entire life. Did you know that?
I know. It's a horrible thing. But that's kind of a fight because I pushed him and then he socked me and, you know, whatever. That's a fight.
Yeah. But you can't really hurt somebody when you're in like second grade.
Yeah, you can. There was blood all over everything. What do you mean?
But kids are resilient.
My nose is not resilient.
I think you're assuming that your nose was based on the fight. I think that's a genetic thing.
But it happened immediately afterwards.
Okay, I never got in a fight in elementary school, but a kid did throw a rock at my head once.
That sucks.
Yeah. Like, I think he was, like, trying to, like, play catch with a rock. Ugh. Pretty dumb. You don't play catch with a rock. That's the worst thing to play catch with.
There were no balls around. I mean, it was like, what did they, what do we do when we were cavemen? We threw rocks.
They didn't play catch. They just, it was dog back then.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know what? Probably that was the first game ever was catch.
It was catch.
Yeah. Exactly.
I guess it's the world's easiest game to play and consider.
That or charades.
But there was blood everywhere. He threw a rock at my head. Like, it opened up like a gash on my forehead. I wasn't in pain, but like, I was shocked. I touched my head and I saw this blood stuff on my hand. And I said to him, "Did you throw ketchup at me?" And he said, and he was like staring at me, freaked out. He was like, "No." And then I started crying because I realized it was blood. But you just bleed a lot out of your head as a kid and it heals up fast.
You bleed a lot out of your head.
There's a lot of blood in your head.
I guess.
I could have gotten in a fight a year ago because me, my mom, and my aunt were in Atlantic City and we were taking a Greyhound bus and it was like late. So there's like this long line and there were these two guys that weren't waiting in line and they were on the side. And my aunt was saying, they better not try to cut. So whenever the Greyhound bus came, she said, "You guys are cutting." And then this guy got mad. He was like, "What are you talking about? What are you doing?" And then my mom was like, "Hey, that's my sister. Don't you talk." And then he started yelling at her. And then it got to where my mom, she hid behind me and she was like, "This is my son." And I was like, I don't want to get in the fight.
Yeah. Just leave me out of this.
Yeah. And I was like, "Hey, I don't want any trouble." But anyway, he got on the bus and it was really weird because I had to go to the bathroom once, but he was sleeping.
That's why you don't start a fight with somebody before you get in a closed vehicle with them for a long period of time.
Yeah, but and it's also like he can hit me. If he hits her, though, he gets in trouble, like, big time.
Right.
Like, but
well, that's the only reason she even started this shit in the first place, because she knew you were around to absorb any sort of blows. So, Daryl, in this film, Miller's Crossing, the ethnic slurs fly fast and furious throughout. People are calling each other out for being Irish or being Italian or whatever. Have you ever felt disparaged because of your ethnicity?
What is your ethnicity?
What is your ethnicity?
I mean, Caucasian. I think I looked it up. I think I'm like German Irish kind of.
Cause this depicted like a time period, and this was really true a century ago, where, I mean, it was mostly white people, but we found a way to like subdivide each other and like, you know, ethnically discriminate against each other just for being white. Irish people hated Italian people.
For sure. you just found reasons to hate each other for
sure. Yeah. No matter what, you find ways to divide.
Yeah.
Yourselves.
I mean, I don't know, like, nowadays, I mean, maybe I just, like, guilt a little bit, but I mean, it's not bad. Not near as bad as, I got nothing to complain about, so. I think I have, like, a 16th, like, Cherokee or something.
Everybody does.
Yeah.
So not, cool. I don't. That's why it's cool to me.
I don't think I'm any part Native American.
I'm not. Yeah. Where are you? You're not from LA, though, are you?
No, I'm from Texas.
Okay.
Like, Dallas.
Good.
Like,
I love Texas.
So nobody's ever said, "You stupid Texan, get out of our way."
Actually,
well,
there is
some of that. Yeah.
Which I think sucks, just for the record. I totally support you, Daryl.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I get, like, some of the people in Texas are kind of dumb, but, like, but also Texas is just cool. Like, the...
Mm-hmm. I have a pillow at home, and it's a, because it's from when I went to my best friend's bridal shower in Houston, and I got this pillow there because I love Texas so much, and it says misplaced Texan. So, I love Texas.
So, you're, like, an honorary misplaced Texan.
Wow.
I am.
I wasn't very Texas until I left Texas, and then I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I got to represent. It's not, I wouldn't have a Texas flag in Texas because then it's
right,
like,
it's annoying.
I'm,
it's like,
I'm here. Yeah.
I have like a little Texas flag, like a notepad thing. You know, those like little stacks of paper and I have a print on the side. So, you know, like, you know, it's
printed.
So I have one of those in my office because it was like just one of the things in the gift bag from the bridal shower. And so I keep it in my office and it's like really interesting because sometimes people come by and they're just like, "Oh, like, what's that?" Or like, you know, people kind of give you shit for the Texas thing. And I'm like, "Really? You don't even know what you're talking about."
People definitely do. People on the coasts are snobby about being on the coasts and see everything in between as kind of a wasteland.
Yeah, totally. For stuff in between, like, Texas is the big thing that is in between.
Yeah.
Like,
right,
it's a huge state, yeah.
You know, okay, I'm Jewish. That's obviously my ethnicity. And I grew, although it's kind of a religion in addition to being ethnicity, it's in a weird middle ground.
But I
went to a Jewish private school from, like, K through 12. So I was surrounded pretty much entirely by Jews that entire time. And I didn't really strongly identify as Jewish until I left that little bubble.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, now I'm carrying all that around with me. But while I was in middle and high school, I was like, I could care less about all this.
Yeah.
I don't believe in any of this shit.
Mm.
But then it becomes a cultural identity once you leave that.
It's exactly that, yeah. Totally.
And anti-Semitism, of course, isn't nearly like what it used to be.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find in LA, hard to find like real anti-Semitic stuff. But still, people die for being Jewish around the world all the time. It's a weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So, the cops of this film are incredibly corrupt. Have you ever had an experience with a dirty cop?
I don't know. I always feel like they're just like, oh, I'm better than you. It always feels like that.
Well,
I think
that's definitely a cop thing.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I went through a DUI checkpoint and they made me get out and for 30 minutes and there was nothing like. I didn't have anything, like, They made me take the test.
There was something they didn't like and they were picking.
Yeah, and then they...
Yeah, I kind of count that. Sometimes it's just like inappropriately exercising their power and and kind of getting off on it.
Yeah,
totally,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I complained appropriately. And
good for you.
It's like, I'm not a fan of cops unless they're saving your life or something.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's horrible.
When you need them, you're obviously thankful that they're around.
Yeah, yeah.
But the rest of the time, you hear sometimes cops talk about this, that whenever people drive past a cop car, a cop pulls them over, they're instinctively nervous, like, oh shit, this person could do things to me, like, with impunity.
I think I recently got over that for some reason. I'm not sure why. But I haven't had, like, dirty cop experiences, but I did have, like, I remember this one time I was making a left turn, and there's, like, a left turn pocket, but it's on Sunset, and, like, there is oncoming traffic, but there's also, like, a light for it, so while our lane could go forward, they couldn't come towards us, you know, because it was like an arrow or something.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of went a little bit ahead of the pocket because there's traffic and everybody on Sunset does that. And I got pulled over for like crossing the double yellow. And the cop that pulled me over was just like the most condescending person ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this was maybe like a few years ago, so I must have been like 22, but I look young, like I look like I could be a teenager. And he's giving me like this big lecture, like, you know, the young people are like dying on the street. I'm like, I know, but like I wasn't doing anything that was like a young reckless person, you know? And I was like kind of getting that big lecture, and I was just like, oh, I hate you. Like, I'm a lawyer, leave me alone kind of thing. You know, it was like,
you can pull that card. You could be like, I know my rights.
Oh my God, you never do that. I think the worst thing to do if you get in trouble with a cop is to try to like be a lawyer, because they're probably like, ugh, I think they hate it.
They'll keep you longer.
Exactly.
But it's also like, I don't know, I could see myself being like, I got nothing else to do. I'm going to waste time and annoy them.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, I was, like, definitely on my way somewhere. Although, I did have one really, really cool cop. I was driving home, like, really late at night. And it was, like, at, like, 2 in the morning after the office. And I wasn't texting. I was on Instagram. But, you know, like, it wasn't traffic. It was, like, whatever. And I think it was kind of a stoplight. But I drove past a cop car or something. Or the cop car drive past me. And the cop just, like, he kind of saw what I was doing, so he just turned around like out of his driver's window and just like made like the texting motion and was like, no, like shaking his head. He was like, yeah, he was kind of like, no, no, no. And I was like, sorry. And just like hands up, and he drove away. And I was like, wow, that was incredible.
I think
he like had every right. Look,
I think
my phone in my
I got to say, I feel like if you're a cop, you just see that all the time. I think
but people get pulled over for it all the time too.
Sure,
so.
But I feel like I think if you're a cop, you probably pull over like a 20th of the people you see texting.
Yeah,
you just
maybe
kind of see people texting.
But it would have been so easy for him to pull me over. Like there was no traffic. It was late at night. It was like 2 a.m. But
that, or you just use it as a pretext to pull over somebody you want to pull over already, like somebody you think looks suspicious.
That's true.
That's what I really think it is. Like, I've never had a really bad cop experience, but I also wonder if that's just because I'm like a middle class white guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're like, if you live in a bad part of town, or if you're like black or Hispanic, cops will just find a reason to pull you over. You can't get away with just texting for no reason.
That's true.
But yeah, also when watching that though, is like, it's a great time to be a cop and be a dirty cop. You just make money and
good God.
It doesn't seem that hard. You're just around and you're like, oh, we're making all this. Oh, we ignore all this crime that's happening. Let's just relax.
Well,
because he's just a chief. Like, what is he going to do?
When you're a cop who's just in the pocket of the mafia, you're essentially a criminal yourself. So you just kind of get to be a criminal and have fun. That's the life.
Mm-hmm.
In this film, John Turturro plays a crooked bookie. Are you a fan of horse racing? And what is the best or worst bet you've ever made in any situation?
I was in Indianapolis when I was moving here. I was just like, we drove across the country from New York to here.
Yeah.
We stopped in Indianapolis and there was just like a horse racing thing. I was like, why not? And I bet like $3 he suggested who, and that horse got like third. So I got like $1 back or something. So, I mean, yeah, that's it.
My dad used to take me to the horse racing track every so often. I think I've gone like 4 or 5 times.
Wait, is there one near here?
There is one. There's one in like Hollywood.
Oh,
no,
wow.
It's not in Hollywood. It's called Hollywood Park.
Oh, that's what it is. Yeah, it's Hollywood Park.
Oh, I've drove by that.
Yeah, it's like Santa Ana maybe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's really weird because it's a bunch of like little small bets like that. At least that's what I remember making, is like just betting like $20 on a horse with a funny name. Mm-hmm. And they give you these books that have all these complicated stats about the horses and how they're bred and what their odds are. And it seems to be nothing when you're actually watching the race.
Mm-hmm. If I was going to bet, it would just be probably based on like their name or which one's prettiest.
That's all I did. Like I just funny name all the way.
Yeah.
Or sometimes the long shots, because you're like you want to make a little money.
Mm. Am I right in saying that if you bet on, sometimes you don't even make any money if they win?
I think some horses actually have even odds.
Yeah,
I don't understand why you bet on that.
I don't understand betting. Sorry. I hear what you're saying.
But even a best case scenario, it's like, congratulations, you bet $20, you get $22 back.
Yeah.
Good job.
That seems like a waste of time. Yeah, that's not that great.
Yeah.
But there's people, you can tell there's people at that track who just, they spend their whole lot, they spend like every day sitting in the booth watching the horses go, studying that little sheet of paper, making their picks. Huh. They have like horse betting radio shows.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. You can just listen to people saying the odds on the horses.
That's so weird. I wonder if there's like a podcast that comments on the races.
They got a podcast for everything.
I know. That's what's so funny to think about.
Horse race. Yeah.
I should have called them up and gotten their thoughts on horse racing for this show. Are you like a gambler in general?
I go to Vegas and play craps. That's my game.
Craps.
That's the only thing.
That's one I just do not understand.
Oh, it's so fun. You should understand it because it's the most fun.
Because it's a combination.
You should understand.
A friend of mine recently took me to Vegas and tried to get me to understand both craps and roulette, and it got roulette a little bit, but craps, it's like you got to throw the dice at a certain part of the table.
All you do is just bounce it off the opposite
wall.
I mean, I don't know. I just read a web. It's I'll try to explain. If you, on your first roll, whatever that number is, you try to roll that number again before you roll a seven, and seven's bad unless it's the first roll. That's short, but there's a lot more. But anyway, what's so fun about it is like everybody's on the same team, and I don't know if you saw it while you're there, but people giving high fives, that happens a lot.
I did notice it. Yeah, everybody's like crowded around the table. Game. It's there is kind of a community to that.
And yeah, and like when a roll's going good, everybody's like, woo! Like fives, and it's awesome, and it's like
I've seen craps, but I haven't played.
Like, we're all gonna be winners, like, man. We're all gonna be rich. Yeah. We're all gonna do it.
Yeah, and I've won a lot one time, but this last time I played kind of stupid and lost a little bit. But then I remembered how I should bet, and we'll see how it goes a third time if I win or lose.
You're gonna win.
Yeah.
I sometimes think like casinos will make especially complicated games just so they can like trick people who bet into like making mistakes or
I think a little bit, because there are some kind of a little bit of like more dumb bets on the table and some in craps or and stuff,
right? Like blackjack, I think
skill to craps, right?
It's what
like craps, like there's not really skill except for how you throw the dice.
Well, yeah, if you're the shooter, but the challenge is like statistics. There's a lot of statistics knowing. Yeah. Like, it's going to be most likely that they roll this. And also, you kind of have to watch. Like, for me, I see how they're rolling. Mm-hmm. And that determines what bets I'm making.
I see.
Because the last time I went, I was just, like, betting. Like, everybody was, like, hot. Like, really good. And then it was like, oh, yeah, I have to wait for them to prove themselves. Because what I was doing is I would bet. And then they roll a seven, like, right after that. And I'd lose it all. And it was like, oh, I'm stupid. I have to wait.
Well, no, like, all these games, there's, like, even though they're all games of chance, there's a skill to, like, blackjack, because, you know, you got to figure out when to hit. And
that's the one game I'm really good at.
Yeah.
Or slots. There's a skill to understanding, like, which machines are hot and pulling the lever at the right time and getting that jackpot.
Yeah, and craps, it's like people are hot, but it's also, like, people, just when they roll, they do roll certain numbers. Like, there was this girl that was just rolling fives, like, crazy, just rolling fives and over, but it's super fun. It's like if you ever played like basketball or football or something in high school and you're like team win, it's like that same, like, oh, our team's winning.
I don't think you feel the same thing at like a poker table. I think everybody just wants to be
You're individuals, like,
to me that's how it should be. It's like, if I'm gonna take this casino for all it's worth, if you get money, that means I'm losing money, essentially. Zero-sum game at the poker table. It is time to dive into the big review ski. Yeah! Oh, yeah! 1990s, Miller's Crossing, starring...
Not 1990s. Oh, sorry.
What?
My bad. Sorry, talking about the scene.
No. The scenes all took place long ago.
My bad.
This is the Coen Brothers' first period piece.
Yes.
Which they would go on to do a whole lot more period pieces. Mm. This is their first time actually deciding to try to do another era. Starring Gabriel Byrne, John Turturro, John Polito, stacked cast.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie about hats and men who wear hats and men who take off hats, who are looking for hats and putting on hats.
looking for hats.
There's lots of hats.
There's a lot of hats. And really, I don't know what the hat thing is about, except that just back in the day, everybody used to wear hats. But I still think there's got to be some sort of... There seems like there's some sort of complicated symbolism between the guys who are wearing hats and the guys who aren't wearing hats.
I don't get the hat thing. I know I get the I get the crossing thing. There's lots of crossing that happens.
Oh,
tons of crossing.
See, I didn't even get that double entendre until you mentioned it. But yeah, there is a whole lot of double crossing happening.
Yeah, tons of it.
There's nobody named Miller though.
There's nobody named Miller. Because at first I was like, is he Tom Miller? No, it's not.
Yeah, I think there is something about hats though. With like, it has to do with like respect and also something about I think like humility too. I think there's some symbolism.
Like when you lose your hat, it means that you're kind of taken down a notch, and when you put your hat back on, you're taking control.
Because he takes, Dane takes off Tom's hat when they go to Miller's Crossing, and he's about to shoot him. Does Tom take off his hat at the end?
No, I think he puts his hat on at the end.
Oh,
yeah, like his hat is off, and then he tells off Leo, and Leo leaves, and then like he puts his hat on, and it's really
because he's his own person, he's his own man.
He's become his own man. And you know, at the very beginning of the movie, he lost his hat, and you got that little shot of the hat blown away in the breeze, and then he regains his hat, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Although at various times in the movie, he again has a hat and loses it and gains it. But
yeah,
it's really complicated.
I think if you have the hat, you have the power. Because I mean, when he takes John Turturro in the woods, you definitely see his hat. His hat is under, and he's looking.
Oh yeah, no,
the whole time,
like, you can barely see his eyes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like the hat is like covering up his face and trying to understand what people are thinking and feeling is a huge theme of this movie in general. I do love the look of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Coen brothers have a really interesting take on the period, and I think Jackie that you didn't feel like it was super period accurate.
Oh yeah, just aesthetically, I was kind of like, I mean to be fair, and we talked about this when we were watching it too. Like maybe it's a budget issue, but. It was like, well, first of all, the first telephone they were using was like from 1901, I feel like. It was like the little black phone with the different pieces and hello? Like, it was just like not a normal phone.
Well,
they had the rotary phone.
Yeah.
And I feel like those were not, I mean, whatever. But I just think like parts of the set were not period specific.
But if you felt like some of them were older, I mean, that's almost realistic. You know, sometimes you see guys with flat screen TVs now, but you also see guys who have old like CRT TVs.
I guess so.
It's just old technology sticks around for a while.
But I would even just like the sets and furniture were a little bit off to me. Like at first I couldn't tell, but it was supposed to be 1920s based on the cars.
It's like 20s or 30s maybe.
I want to say 20s because of the cars.
I think, well, in the description, it definitely said Prohibition. In the description on Amazon Plus, it said Prohibition era.
I mean, although...
So, yeah.
Yeah, although everybody's... But at the Shenandoah Club, everybody's drinking out in the open. It's not like a speakeasy.
Well,
at the same time, though...
The police... So it is because the police choose to raid the places when Leo tells them.
No, that's true. That's totally true.
Also, I was wondering where this... what location this took place, and they mention Los Angeles at one point.
No,
but it's he talked about it like as a faraway place.
Oh no, yeah, it's definitely not LA.
He mentions it, so it's like it near that, but it doesn't seem near that at all.
They deliberately never mention the city.
Mm-hmm.
I assume it's somewhere like New England.
Yeah.
It seems kind of East Coast. Where it was shot is New Orleans.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Apparently, the Coens just really liked the scenery, and they felt like they found something unique about the location of the period.
Might have been good, like filming like tax credits and stuff too.
I wonder. In 1990, it could have been part of it. Just been a money saving measure. One thing they definitely said about the development of the movie was that you always see gangsters in a city, but you never see gangsters in a forest.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason they wanted to have those forest scenes is to kind of take the gangster motifs out of their element.
Oh, that's true. Although that forest scene made me think of The Sopranos. But that Sopranos was after.
But Sopranos was after. Well, Sopranos probably took a little interpretation, you know. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, when Boardwalk Empire goes in the woods too. I mean, yeah, they're after.
I don't watch Boardwalk Empire yet. I should.
Yeah.
This whole movie, and I mean, and a whole lot of Coen Brothers movies, but this movie especially, like, they grew up on like novels by Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and James Caan, mm-hmm. and these original like detective writers who kind of inspired film noir and gangster mm-hmm. movies. And in particular, this movie was inspired by Dashiell Hammett's The Red Harvest, which mm-hmm. Time magazine called one of the top 100 books of the last 100 years, and inspired, among other things, Yojimbo, which was Kurosawa movie, and A Fistful of Dollars, the Clint Eastwood movie. Just, and that concept of, you know, the basic plot is just there's a guy who's caught in between two rival gangs and kind of playing both sides off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is essentially the Coen Brothers' twist on that concept.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very classically shot and very stately and a little bit slow.
Yeah.
Which you could count as kind of a strike against the movie, and I do think it, especially in the early going, it's a little bit slow for my taste.
But something that's good about that is like when action does happen, it's like very like, whoa, awesome.
Right.
Resting
it makes
game.
It yeah, yeah.
Improv, duck, duck, goose.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, mm-hmm. it's true. It's building up this world so that when you do get to those explosive moments, they hit a little bit harder.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, I actually kind of liked the pace. I mean, I may have been, you know, sleepy while watching it, but that wasn't really the movie's fault.
Yeah, we did watch it. We did watch it very late last night.
Yeah, but I thought the pacing was fine, but that might be a personal issue that I have is sometimes when people are talking about stuff like gambling or sporting stuff that I don't know what they're talking about, that I'm like, I don't know what you're saying right now, so I was having a little bit of a problem with that between being tired.
Yeah,
but it wasn't really their fault.
I was fine with it, too, because I thought, yeah, the characters were really interesting. The dialogue, yeah. I thought was really good. It's just...
Casper's face is, like, the best part.
Yeah, yeah.
God, I love John Polito in this film. Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
But, no, the dialogue, it's a double-edged sword, because it is really cool, and I love the use of 30s slang. I think
And that part I also
appreciate. I think more than anything, the Coen brothers are having fun with period dialogue here, and mm-hmm. and it really mm-hmm. shows in the script, but at the same time it makes it sometimes hard to figure out what's going on.
Although I would say there's something, which is I'm noticing it for the third time as we like go through all the movies, is there's something not crisp about the just like the sound when people are talking. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of the time I'm like, what are you saying? Like, it's not, I don't know why, but I feel like in most films that I watch, you hear what they're saying very clearly, and I feel like in Coen brothers movies, I'm like, wait, what did you kind of just say? And I have good hearing, so
yeah,
I don't think it's a sound or volume issue.
I don't get that at all. I thought the dialogue was super crisp.
But it also might, I think the thing is that,
you know, they have
seen the movies a few times, so you also kind of know what they're saying. Whereas for me watching it a first time, like, it's just quite, it's not quite as clear.
Daryl, did you notice any sound issues?
I mean, maybe a little bit. I don't think they, like, some of the dialogue they don't put as much emphasis on, because the stuff they want to hammer home is repeated a lot, like question of ethics.
Ethics comes up.
Yeah, other lines too. I can't remember right
Nobody
now.
Nobody knows anybody, not that well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that one. Yes, that's another
that's
one.
A big one.
Yeah, like there's the themes that they want you to hear.
It.
They repeat it. It comes back.
Yeah.
Or are you giving me the hi-hat? I just love phrase or take your flunky and dangle. I love that stuff. that is so much fun, and I think that's a major strength of this movie, and as well as though something that makes it a little bit off-putting, because it took me like this was my third time watching this movie, and I feel like I didn't completely understand all the details of the plot until that third time.
Yeah,
it's
Jeremy
a complicated
had to explain
plot.
Some of it to me afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the first time I got. Like the big things and like the awesome scenes, I was like, oh, that was so cool. But this time I like really concentrated and it was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I really concentrated and tried to pay attention like 100%. And
because it's just, there's a lot of complicated relationships between characters, and it is scene after scene of, conversations about illegal activities and these just gigantic wood burnished rooms, and there's lots of just beautiful browns and greens in terms of the color palette. I do like that production design, and I like overall the visual aesthetic and how it is very classically shot. And there's a lot of you know, fades to blacks, and there's a lot of two shots, and there's a lot of very classical, very old school filmmaking technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always like their cinematography, or so far I have. I'm always like, ooh, cinematography. I like it.
It's a big change up from their last couple, which was a little bit more kinetic and more moving mm-hmm. cameras yeah. and more exciting.
But still, they had some cool shots in this too, even though it was more classically shot. Like, some of their close-ups were, I thought, nicely done. So.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it definitely gives the actors room to play. Mm-hmm. And overall, the performances in this movie are fantastic.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. John Polito, you mentioned, he really doesn't show up in anything other than Coen Brothers movies, I don't think. But he's great. He's mm-hmm. great here. He does he's got this incredibly expressive face. Mm-hmm. You mentioned his mouth.
I think I also mentioned while we're watching, he looks like one of those SpongeBob characters, like the fish characters. Which he totally does, but it was great. I love that, like, hanging open mouth.
Yeah, he's got like a floppy fish mouth.
Like, it's so good.
Yeah, I think out of like all the character, he's the most like character-y, if that makes like he's the most like
it's
animated.
It's the biggest. Like, it is the biggest performance for sure.
Yeah, yeah, but it's great.
He's the Italian one too.
So yeah, totally. It does make sense. Yeah,
I feel like the movie is livened up when he's on screen because mm-hmm. you can't really look away from that performance. Mm-hmm. Similarly with John Turturro, he only has a couple moments of screen. He actually only really has a couple scenes in this movie, but he makes the most out of them.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't. The movie starts with talking about Bernie Birnbaum, but you don't actually see Bernie Birnbaum mm-hmm. until like half an hour into the movie.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah, that's true.
When we get to
he did so good.
That first scene where he's about to get shot.
We can talk about that.
Oh, okay.
John Turturro has said he wasn't that well known before this movie was shot. Although, like we mentioned with Raising Arizona, with like catching Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter just as they were becoming a star, in 1989, John Turturro did Do the Right Thing, which was his breakout performance. And this came like right after that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right. So catching an actor just at the right time. But he said he found that look in your heart scene especially hard to shoot.
It was unreal. It was so good.
It was so good because something I like about it is it's like maybe, you know, writers would be like, oh, he'd say different things trying to come. But no, it's powerful that he says the same thing over again. Because if you're about to get shot, if you're about to die, maybe you are panicking and you can only think of one thing
to say over and over again.
He just says this. He says it like 15 times and it's awesome. It's so great.
Well, okay. It's an amazing scene. But a question I will pose here. Because of what we know about Bernie Birnbaum and because of the overall theme of how we never really know what's going on with people, do you think some of that emotion was a show to try
on
to get
his
it
part?
On his part
for
to try
sure.
to get
oh
to
absolutely
get
yeah him. He's a liar yeah
but it was so accurate. Okay, so even though, as you know, I hate violence in mm-hmm. movies, I thought this one again was, even though it was violent, it was like a very good reflection of humanity, which I love in movies, and I like that they capture that, because in this one it was like that scene was so powerful, and then a few scenes later, right when he's like, what are we going to do when you came out to, like, you know, shoot me? Remember when he was, like, trying to, like, jump around out his window and come back with a gun? And he was basically saying, like, yeah, I would have just, like, done the same thing to you.
Yeah, and I'll just squirt a few and you won't shoot me.
Yeah, but I thought, like, it was so true because you can, like, there's something about that that's, like, so manipulative, obviously, and that, like, you know will work. And I thought they just did a really good job of capturing, like, yeah, he's, like, a squirmy little, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
He's a bad character, but... in that moment, like, you have so much compassion for him because you're like, you're gonna get shot, like, this is horrible.
It makes you think, this guy is a scumbag, but does he deserve to die? Does he deserve to just be kind of shot in the woods like a fucking animal?
Like an animal, yeah.
But something's also interesting when he says, don't look, or look in your heart.
Yeah,
it's like he really doesn't want to die, but he doesn't mean look in your heart. He doesn't mean that. What he means is, I don't want to get shot. I don't want to die. But he's going to say, look in your heart. Like, it's a lie. He's lying. Yeah. But at the same time, he doesn't want to. He's saying something other than what he really means. Because he's a scumbag and he doesn't care about looking. He's just saying whatever works in that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
And it turns out it did work on Tom, at least for that moment.
Yeah.
But it didn't work a second time.
Nope.
Because what heart? Mm-hmm. But he had to lose his heart in order to make everything work out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As much as I love John Polito, as much as I love John Turturro, I mean, Gabriel Byrne really is the anchor of this movie. Mm-hmm. And it's It's a much subtler performance, but it's kind of an incredible performance in its own right.
Kind of.
Totally. Yeah. Because he's playing a very inexpressive character and an inscrutable mm-hmm. character and somebody who we're supposed to not be totally sure what his angle is and what his motive is all
but
the way
was
through.
He so expressive in being non-expressive. His eyes were like, I don't know if you noticed one of the first scenes where I think it was a door was opening and it must have been with Verna, but there was just like the way that like his eyes, not even like twinkle, but just something like would like go over his eyes like many times or it's just like this recognition and reaction. And then it would go away. It was mm-hmm. so well done. It was like very, very nuanced. It was amazing.
No, it's you could tell when he's in control and you can tell when he's not in control. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And possibly my favorite moment in the whole movie is actually that second return to Miller's mm-hmm. Crossing, where it's just so much dread. Where you know he's not going to find a body, and you can see this slowly dawning on him. Like, this is it for me.
Yeah,
now I've seen. Yeah, and he puked, and you think it's over for him, and then they find a body anyways, and you're like, what?
Yeah, that was great. That was really good.
The theme of this whole movie is trust, I think. And just how you can't really know anybody and how...
Yeah.
Not that well.
The first monologue, the first moment in the movie is you've got Johnny Casper talking about ethics. And it's ironic because he's talking about the ethics of how you can't even trust a bookie to fix a fight anymore properly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But...
Where's the trust?
but he's I think, making a genuine point as well about how any sort of, like... relationship and business or whatever is impossible if you can't understand, have some faith in what the other person is thinking.
Yeah.
Like how you could never know what Tom is thinking or what Verna is thinking or which side she's playing.
Yeah.
Or for anybody.
I think about that a lot in real life. I don't know if that's a little bit of a tangent, but I thought, I just love that line so much of like, you can't really know anybody not that well. It's true in real life too, because, you know, as we get older and like we meet new people that we haven't known all our lives, you have to like assume trust in your adult relationships because you don't have like that much like action to, you know, have observed like before that. So I kind of like think about that, like when you meet new people and you like start trusting them and then, I don't know, you kind of like, you know, sometimes you're disappointed, but it's so interesting because it's true. Like you never really do know anybody that well.
No, you know, so Ethan Coen is a philosophy major mm-hmm. and I think he brings a strong philosophical bent to his movies, which is part of what I love about them.
Yeah.
But, you know, ethics comes up repeatedly, and the idea, and there is an idea in, like, you know, Kantian ethics of you treat other people the way you want to be treated, mm-hmm. the classic golden rule, the way you think everybody should treat everyone else, because that figures heavily into why we value trust in, because you can't conduct business without trust.
Right.
You can't form an alliance with people. You can't fall in love without trust. You can't form any kind of relationship without assuming that other people are going to act similarly to the way you act, even in unethical business relationships.
Yeah. The thing is, and also in this movie, it's like taking that to the extreme. Like there is, everybody is double crossing. Every relationship there's double crossing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And ethics, nobody has ethics.
No.
Nobody.
Well, except for, you know, like Johnny Casper, who's constantly pleading for ethics.
Yeah.
And says how much he hates a double cross artist. It's weird.
But
that,
then he double crosses Dane.
Right.
Even
as he's saying, I hate a double cross artist, he's essentially double crossing him.
Yeah.
But we're all like that. That's what's so weird, like, as humans.
Right.
We all are like, I feel like we all stick to our guns. And, like, I consider myself pretty principled, but I know there's times where we're like, well, not in this situation. I don't know.
Ultimately, everybody is looking out for number one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, and also Casper is just kind of a loose cannon, and you can't it's not that he's trying to trick you, it's that you can't trust him because he could just go off and do something crazy at any moment.
Yeah.
And it plays into the fact that the institutions in this movie you can't trust either. You can't trust the cops.
Ugh, mm-hmm.
The cops are not there to enforce law and order.
Just a chief.
Yeah, I'm just the police chief. What can I do? Johnny Casper, like, literally kicks the mayor out of his own office.
Yeah. It's like, get out.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, God. That's like the extreme version of me, because sometimes I'm like teased by my friends like being bratty, and I just think like, how funny would that be? Like, I would just like love to kick somebody out of their office. So ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh.
But it, yeah, but it just shows like, yeah, this is a world where like there kind of are no rules, and just whoever can enforce being in charge the best is in charge.
Yeah, and like the secretary like comes and brings him drinks like after he's kicked out the mayor, like while the mayor's on the way out, she's like bringing the other guy.
Francis McDormand, who's the secretary, by the way.
Yes.
And also, yeah, and it's great also with the power thing and the mayor's double crossing with the mayor with Leo, and then you see the mayor with Casper, and they do the same exact thing. It's the mayor and one of the the commissioner or something.
Yeah,
they both look at Tom the same way when he walks in.
They repeat that shot multiple times.
Yeah, and it's so great. The first time I saw it, I was like, yes, so great.
And then by the end, you know, Tom does reveal that he's kind of, even though he broke that trust with Leo. There's that ironic moment where he's like, you got to trust me on this. And then says, I've actually been lying to you about sleeping with Verna this whole time.
Yeah.
Which is its own irony. But then it turns out he has been on Leo's side the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
But then he doesn't actually want to join back up with Leo.
Yeah.
Which, and it's, I don't know, how do you guys interpret that moment? Because I think his motives are deliberately kind of inscrutable there. And trying to understand why he went out of his way to do all this for Leo, but then doesn't want to actually be on his side.
I guess he just wanted to... Well, what he did do, though, is he got money to pay off the guy that he owed, the Lazarine, or whatever his name
is. Yeah, Lazar.
He got that money. So maybe he just wanted that money and he just wanted out. I don't know. Because that's where he ends up, because it seems like he ends up back at the beginning, but he did get that paid off.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, right. I mean, maybe he just wanted... I don't see why he would care, but I guess maybe he just wanted peace. I mean, he was talking about, like, making things right at the beginning. He's like, you just gotta kill Bernie, and everything will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But... at the end, he does make everything okay. Just a lot more people die.
Right.
And he gets a pay.
He can't do it at first. Yeah. He can't kill Birdie at first, but then he eventually has to kill Birdie to make things right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he wanted, like in a weird way, he was principled because he wanted to stand by Leo. But then I think you can like support, like you'd be on somebody's side and support them without like getting involved in it too, like by the end. Like you support somebody, but then you're like, but I'm not actually like going to get into this anymore. So I think I can kind of see.
Yeah, and maybe it's a sign that their bond at the beginning of the movie was pretty strongly established.
Yeah.
Like you could tell they really cared about each other.
Yeah.
But by the end, I think that even though Leo really was like, damn it, I need you back, that I think that trust was just permanently broken at that point. Not easy to repair.
Yeah, I mean, I could see how like after, you know, like Verna and everything, he just... And I mean, everything he had to go through too, I could just see how a person would be like, I'm going to do the right thing because I think this is the right thing. But then there's like a limit to how much I need to personally invest myself in it anymore. I kind of see it that way.
But also, do you think like when they were writing this, they're like, should he go back or should he not? Well, I don't think he should go back because it's sort of like a crossing again.
Right.
Because if he went back, then everything. But since he's not going back, it's still kind of a double cross, kind of. Because he expects him to come back. He's like, you're my friend. You come back with me, right? No. You know, I think that's kind of like what it is, too. They're just writing, and it's like, should he go back or should he not go back? He shouldn't go back, because that's a halfway double cross still.
That's interesting. Right. I don't think it's a cross.
But no, I don't know if it's a cross at that point.
It's
either.
Like a half.
It's like a not as much loyalty.
Like it's, if he went back, then it would definitely not be a cross. But since he doesn't go back, it's like in between, kind of.
Yeah.
So I guess they wanted to go more for what would be the cross, kind of, still.
I don't know.
It's definitely breaking from the loyalty of it.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if he was always intent on playing Casper. I think it's strongly implied that there was, that after he initially left Leo, that he may have really wanted to switch sides and then eventually decided he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But his motives are obscured.
I think he's very like out for himself too.
Yeah.
At the end of it. And almost like, I don't know if it's like even in the worst way, because typically like we don't like that character that's like out for himself. But if you look at that situation, like it's so crazy, like being between Leo and Casper and all these people are dying and the cops are involved. Like it's a dirty situation. So I mean, we don't have enough information, but I sort of got the sense that he was like maybe the most like moral in that situation, and so he was like trying to not be involved by the end of it, like to the extent possible.
Well, yeah, I mean, he definitely had, you know, trouble killing anybody out
right
of every,
yeah. So it just kind of seems like, you know, I mean, obviously he was, you know, he was part of the whole scene, I mean, you know, interaction,
right? But he kind of
be a killer, and
he was kind of a softie underneath all that.
Yeah. Like, I think he was sort of a little bit, like, above it. Like, those guys were, like, you know, Casper and Leo are, like, really in this. They're, like, committed
to, yeah. Oh, yeah,
to,
they're, like, they're legitimate killers.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, but they're really committed to it. And I think, like, he wasn't. So, yeah, there's...
So maybe it was his way of just getting out of the whole scene.
Yeah.
That's justifiable.
I think that's it. Yeah, he's just not a killer. He just doesn't want to... He killed when he had to.
Yeah, he finally killed Bernie at the very end, but that was it.
Yeah.
Which brings me actually to an interesting point. There's only two scenes in the entire movie that doesn't have Tom in them. One of them is the kid pulling the toupee off of Rug Daniels in the alley. Mm-hmm. Which is just kind of a little joke moment, but funny. Mm-hmm. And then the Danny Boy scene, the famous Danny Boy scene. And I saw one person make a point online that this is basically like a first person perspective movie, like following a single person through the movie. That's the only scene that breaks from it. And he argued that Cohen shouldn't have included it because it's a great scene, but it's kind of just a show off-y scene for show off's purpose.
I can see that.
But
I love it.
I thought it was so great. Good. It was, yeah. And it's, I mean, it was so gratifying, even though you're like, I mean, I wasn't really like rooting for Leo, but it was like when he did all that, you're like, I can really respect that. Like, you just took down a bunch of like two guys, came into your house, burned it down, tried to like.
That's the thing. That's why. Okay, that's basically why I think that's actually kind of a crucial scene.
Yeah.
Leo is kind of just making mostly dumb choices through the movie, mm-hmm. and he's like, he decides not to kill Birdie, and he makes it, and he lets, and he kind of cuts Tom loose. And you wonder, how did this guy even get in power in the first place?
That's true.
And I think that's a scene that shows you, hey, this is not a guy to be messed with.
Yeah.
You know,
he was so calm and collected about it.
He's an artist with a Tommy gun.
Well, and at first it seems like, oh, he's going to die. Wow. Okay, well, Tom won't like that. Wait, no, he's not gonna die. Okay, this is awesome. Kill him. Yeah. Then you're like on his side instantly, like when he goes under that bed,
right?
And shoots the guy in the
leg and,
totally. Totally
head.
Badass. Sorry. I know, but the violence in this movie wasn't that bad.
Yes, it was. It was. I mean, so many people get like shot in the head, and there's.
Well, yeah.
I hate violence in movies.
But did you like that part where he like goes out the window and the guy has his back and he just shoots him?
He's just shooting
everywhere.
Oh, I know.
So unnecessary.
Every one of those bullets was necessary. Oh, you need the impact.
But also, it was like emotion. He was angry.
People... No, it was necessary to portray the like emotional part of it, mm-hmm. and I think it's good that they even showed the perspective from the front of the guy, like getting shot up and the blood and whatever. But I still hate blood and I hate violence. So it's really hard for me.
But wasn't there the scene where Dane went in Verna's room and Tom wasn't in that one either, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
It's not.
I guess there is another one.
And then even when what's his face Casper was like in the mayor's office for a little bit, there was no Tom.
Yeah, and then Tom joined in.
No, but, oh yeah, Tom.
I mean, but, I guess he did join. Yeah, the scene,
I think Tom was always there. He was.
Yeah,
just
because he walked in, and then that's when they were talking about Casper's cousins.
But you're right. There was that scene between the Dane and Verna and all.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
And so with that scene, then I say that guy's point is kind of wrong then, because that scene we follow Dane a little bit. Because Dane is trying, but also that scene is about Tom, I guess. Still,
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, that scene is about Tom, whereas Leo's scene is not about Tom at all. It's about
Leo.
What's happening? Yeah. Mm-hmm. This whole thing. Yeah.
Peter Stormare was originally supposed to play the Dane.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and this I think that the character was originally was called the Swede because he's Swedish. Would have been an interesting casting choice, but he mm-hmm. was playing Hamlet at the time and couldn't do it. We will see more of Peter Stormare later on.
Mm-hmm.
But an interesting thing about this movie as well is that, there are ethnic slurs like crazy and people calling each other Guinea and potato eater mm-hmm. and whatnot.
He kept calling the Shmata, too.
And the Shmata and a Hebrew. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, what's Is that a Jewish shmata? Is that Jewish?
Well, that's a Yiddish term.
I think it's Yiddish?
Okay. Yeah.
It's like rag.
A shmata means a rag, yeah.
Okay.
So I was like, I thought that was actually a very good, slur for them to use. I don't know. At least for me, I don't often hear a person referred to that way.
No, so it's pretty, good. Those are some like old school racial slurs that you don't really hear anymore.
Yeah. It was distinct.
But interestingly, at the same time, homosexuality is kind of treated as no big deal. Because there is a gay love triangle at the center of this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But
there
nobody
is?
Ever called... Yeah.
Yeah. And that's another one of the crossings that happen.
No, it's because they talk about it in very subtle terms. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
But...
Plus, because you guys have seen it more than once, so you would have caught it.
Yeah, but the Dane and Mink, Steve Buscemi, are boys... More than boys, they imply. Mm-hmm. But then Mink during Steve Buscemi's one scene, which nice to see Steve Buscemi joining the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Repertoire cast. But he has that one scene where he says, "Okay, I can have more than one friend, can't I? I might be friends with the Dane, but I'm also friends with Bernie."
Yeah, and then Bernie talks about later. I guess it's like the last scene when he's about to. He says. I would go home to Mink, and he would just, you know, the way he always was, you know, overreacting. Yeah, so he like, so yeah. They pretty much, yeah, they lived together, spent the night together. Yeah, all of that, it seems like. So, yeah, there is definitely that.
I miss that. But I see it. It makes sense now. Mm-hmm. It also makes sense that all of that would be happening in the context of, like, this mob problem.
Yeah, and it explains why the Dane takes so personally, kept punishing Tom once he sees Mink dead. And thinks that Tom is responsible for it.
Right.
And also, Dane, like, when Tom blames the Mink, I forgot what he blames him for, but then Dane is like, no, he would never do that, or something.
That
first time when he, I think it's, the,
yeah, no,
it's
they say,
technically the second time he meets with Casper.
Tom says that that Mink is is crooked, too.
Mm-hmm.
And Dane's like, no, he's not. He wouldn't do that. He would never do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Do you guys think it's a cheat that when Tom takes Bernie into the woods and then doesn't shoot him, that the gangsters don't check to see if there's a dead body there?
Oh, yeah. Well, we were definitely saying that. Yeah. I was watching it with a couple friends, and we were all saying, like, it's like he pretty much says, our boss doesn't trust you, but we kind of trust you. So it's like, we don't trust you, but we trust you. Go do this by yourself. Like, why would you say...
Yeah, they just kind of get drunk by the car and...
Yeah. It's like they say, we want to, boss wants to make sure you're one of the good guys. So shouldn't they go with him and make sure he's one of the good guys? Like he's
you would think. It wouldn't take a whole lot to just walk there with him.
I agree. I like that you just called it a cheat because that's kind of what I was thinking. That I was like, come on. You weren't going to check? Like, I thought they would.
The Coen brothers famously ran into writer's block making the script.
Yeah.
Midway through writing Miller's Crossing, they stopped for a month and wrote all of Barton Fink in a month.
Whoa.
And then went back to writing Miller's Crossing. Because they had such a hard time with it, they were like, we need to get our head clear and get away from this.
Huh.
But you can tell, because it is such a complicated plot, and there is so much going on, you could see how it would be difficult to connect all those dots. And I think maybe they just kind of had to have that happen to make the math work.
And then they kind of have a weak justification, sort of, when Dane's like, we got to go check on it. And he's like, yeah, because they didn't make sure that the body was there. And he's like... He said he did it. We heard the shots or something like that. Like,
right.
They're just idiots.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason to check. The boss didn't say we should check.
It's very
like they're just idiots.
The boss didn't say anything.
He didn't say we should go with him.
And certainly the Coen brothers have relied on characters acting stupidly to move the plot along before. So it's not out of character for them. But it feels like, come on, guys.
But there wasn't... Yeah, there certainly wasn't like enough justification as to why they wouldn't... Like, there could be another, maybe better reason. But just like, oh, we didn't know was like not really a reason.
Sorry,
but,
boss.
Yeah, that's not...
Frankie and Tic Tac.
Yeah.
And I mean, it could have maybe been... if they like talked about... We're just going to stay here and get drunk. We don't want to, like, I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe there is a way.
Thing.
Maybe they're just alcoholics and they just don't want to see. They don't want to see blood right now.
Yeah, there should have been something about them. They were like,
we're just gonna relax
and deal with this.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, but if I were Johnny Casper, I'd be like, go and watch the guy.
Yeah.
A little bit of trivia about the movie. Very first image the Coen brothers conceived of writing this movie was that first shot during the credits of a black cat flying away in the wind.
Mm,
and it's never really made explicitly clear what that means.
I thought that was his dream?
He later says it's his dream.
Yeah.
But it's still not clear what it means. It's like a, it's an evocative image.
Maybe it's his dignity flying away. That's what I
Maybe,
think.
Yeah.
I think hats are related to like dignity and
yeah.
that kind of thing.
Because, yeah, we watched that and we're like, oh, hats are important.
Yes,
like,
that's all that tells you is hats are important.
Hats have something.
Pay attention to hats. That's all that means.
Some sort of symbolism. Yeah.
The part of Leo was a very late replacement for Trey Wilson, who played Nathan Arizona in Raising Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
But a few days before principal shooting, he died of a brain hemorrage.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Pretty sad.
Whoa.
So they brought in Albert Finney last minute.
Wow.
Did a pretty credible job with the part.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's so sad.
Yeah, he did. And I think everybody did. Everybody, all these characters were really good.
Okay, I didn't like Verna that much.
I'm kind of with you.
Yeah.
Okay, well... Yeah, now that you say that.
Yeah, sorry.
I didn't think about her. Yeah.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Verna.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, her character, the position that she was in this whole situation, I don't think she was like not emotional about it in a way that wasn't because she's the same as Tom, for example. Like Tom, we can see that he's that kind of like silent type, but like you know stuff is happening.
Mm-hmm.
With her, it was just like not a very like it didn't seem deep to her. Like, she was not that connected to what was going on. But it's like, this is your brother?
You could tell the character was supposed to be a play on, like, the Steely Dame. You know, kind of the femme fatale.
Yeah, but there was something about that, to me, wasn't convincing. It wasn't, like, steely. It was, like, it was just not connected. Like, I feel like a steely person knows what's happening, and then they're steely, but you can, like, see that connection. And I just didn't see that with her because it's, like, it's her brother, it's Tom, like, she's involved with Leo, like, all these things. It was just kind of, like, to me, she always just kind of felt like, I'm just here. And, like, I'm sometimes mad at you when you walk in the door, and I'm going to slam the door in your face, and then I'm going to, you know, I'm going to call the police or pretend to. But it was just, like, it was not...
Yeah.
It was not convincing to me. It wasn't, like, a... There should have been more emotion, or there should have at least been like emotion with Tom or something that was like more fire that you saw.
Yeah, it's just also like it got to that point so much where it's like, why is she doing this with Tom? Why isn't she just staying with Leo? She doesn't seem to be that into Tom.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
Like
yeah.
I think they tried to make it like, oh, they have this like inexplicable, you know... intensity and anger,
yeah, it's
but
like
you didn't
this fighting relationship.
Yeah,
but it didn't really come off.
It totally
I agree.
Didn't feel like that. And I think like her disconnect from Bernie was weird. And also, I know it doesn't like really matter, but she totally didn't seem Jewish, which I thought was just strange because it's like
John Turturro totally did. But.
Right, he's like, you know, look into your heart. Like it was like he was like, and not always, but he was like there was like playing up like that Jewish part of him, and there had to be like, I think they should have made her character steelier in a convincing way, a little bit more Jewish, and those things could have like kind of gone together. Mm-hmm. Like that
it's,
Jewish woman who's kind of like
yeah tense. I honestly don't know if the character is as big of a problem as just the performance itself doesn't quite hit the right notes.
Right.
As Marcia Gay Harden's a great actress. This was her first major film role.
Yeah,
doesn't quite play it.
But
I think she's got one great moment. Her last scene is the one where she's about to kill Tom, holding the gun to his face, and then her face just like kind of crumples because she can't do it. And her facade breaks down. But it would have played more powerfully.
It wasn't the right facade.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's just her. I just think that I don't think the character was developed enough for my case. Because like for me, like. She's the only woman in it, right?
She's pretty much the only woman.
Yeah, so I guess like for me, like watching it as a woman, I'm kind of like, hello, like that's not how you would be acting. I don't know. It wasn't believable to me. So
yeah,
that's my complaint.
And also, yeah, and I mean, just a big thing. I just don't get why she's cheating on Leo because Leo's awesome. I don't know. I think he's awesome.
I mean, Leo's like this old man.
Yeah, I guess, but still,
but
like,
you never even saw their connection either.
Yeah, like, you never. Are they ever even in the same room? I don't even know.
Exactly.
Oh well, I mean, at the end, but they don't really interact. They're just at a funeral.
Yeah, it's just like with Leo and her. You never saw any insight into what that relationship was like until that one time Leo's like. Well, what did he say? Did he say he's going to ask her to marry him?
Yeah.
I was like, what are you talking about? Like, we've never seen you together.
But it's supposed to be crazy that he would ask her to marry him.
Yeah.
But the reason it should be crazy too is like you see something between them and you're like, well, that's not real. Like, you know, like there's, I felt like there should be something that you saw that kind of showed that he was a little delusional about the relationship.
I could argue, and I saw it argued online, that that relationship, both the relationships in Verna are downplayed a little bit because the real love story of the movie is between Leo and Tom.
Yeah.
And so, but I completely see what you're saying. And I think most of the scenes with that character don't quite work.
Yeah. I just don't even think that they needed, she didn't need any more screen time except for like maybe a little bit with Leo. Like, I think that would have been interesting. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a screen time issue or a focus. It was just like the depth of the performance and the character were not, mm-hmm. not enough for me.
Yeah.
So,
in a couple,
it's not your fault, Marcia. Sorry. It's your fault. Going
in a couple episodes, we're going to talk about the Hudsucker Proxy, which is a very different movie, but Jennifer Jason Leigh kind of plays a variation on this, this old school kind of screwball Steely Dame persona that I think is a lot more effective. Okay. That's a really cool performance, but we'll get to that when we get to the Hudsucker Proxy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Overall, I'm with you on that. Gabriel Byrne. Did you know that that's his natural accent?
Yeah, we talked about that during the movie.
Yeah, he's you know, that's his natural Irish part, or a little bit of Irish brogue.
Which I liked, that is his real accent. Yeah. But there were parts where I thought it was inconsistent, but that probably happens when you have a like slight accent and not like a very intense accent.
Yeah, because there was one time where it was like, oh, it is the Irish accent.
Yeah,
there was like, one time, and then it's
like little bits of flecks of Irish coming out.
But it's also real. Real accents aren't like cartoony. Like, I mean, they
not
can
like character. All
they
the time.
Can be like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, so I accept that because I didn't know that it was his real accent. So I was kind of like character work much. You know, like it was like not sticking. But then because it's his real accent, that actually kind of makes sense. You're like, okay, that's fair. You're not always gonna be.
Yeah, like
Mr. Irish.
I remember. Yeah, like listening to some like Norwegian accents. It's not like. I don't know, you would think it'd be like Swedish Chef from the Muppets, like but they kind of sound sort of British a little bit even sometimes. Like the president, I've like listened to him a little bit at his speech and he kind of sounds British.
Mm-hmm.
There's a British like way to it, even though there are some little things they do, and it's like you wouldn't expect that because you think like the cartoony Norwegian, like yeah.
Yeah. That's weird. Accents are weird.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Raimi shows up at one point during the Sons of Cain raid. He's like kind of a laughing gunman who gets shot up a couple seconds later.
Oh, is he the one with the hand?
Yeah, he's with double guns.
Yeah.
Stupid.
Sorry. We're going to talk about Sam Raimi a whole lot more next episode. Yeah. So be excited for that.
I am.
I
had no patience for that scene, though.
No, I know. That was kind of a ridiculous moment.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just like, that was another scene that's kind of unneeded. Because it didn't do anything. It's just,
I know.
And there was like 75 cop cars.
Yeah.
It was so weird.
No, and you notice, they're like unveiling more guns. Like, we need more guns in this scene.
It was just like, you just needed like a couple guns, two cars. Like, why do you, whatever.
At the same time, it's nice to have those little set pieces like that in the scene of the couple of scenes of just cops just destroying a party.
Yeah.
As contrast.
Yeah, that's true.
I mentioned this, I was going to mention this the last couple episodes, but I want to mention it now. Every episode so far, I've noticed a moment that Quentin Tarantino is later stolen from for one of his movies.
Oh.
Like in Blood Simple, during Kill Bill, he goes crazy with the buried alive thing.
Yeah.
Not exactly the same, but he even calls it a Texas funeral.
Right.
Kind of an interesting nod. And then in Raising Arizona, where there's that fight where he's destroying a trailer. You know, like him and Tom and John Goodman are fighting.
Yeah.
And that also happens in Kill Bill, where Uma Thurman and Daryl Hannah are just like destroying a trailer in some crazy fight.
Uh-huh.
In this movie, also in Kill Bill, that moment where Oren Ishii is hiding under the bed and shoots... and shoots the guy in the leg and then shoots him in the head. It's directly copied from Leo doing it in this movie. Like, it's like same shot in it, same shot in everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely true, yeah.
Yeah, Tarantino just stealing shit left and right. I mean, that's what he does, but I'm just calling it out like I see it.
Call it like you see it. Mm-hmm. Case dismissed. I haven't used my tagline
today. Use it now. Use it
case
now.
Case dismissed,
thank
Tarantino.
You. We need to get you a gavel. I'm going to have a gavel here next time.
Oh, it'd be great. It's my tagline.
This movie was made for $10 million. It made only $5 million at the box office.
Oh, that's sad.
But it was hugely critically acclaimed. Made like a, yeah, like 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. Everybody loved this movie. Mm-hmm. Often referred to as the other crime movie of 1990. Mm-hmm. The other one being Goodfellas. Mm. Which, it's an interesting contrast to Goodfellas. Because Goodfellas, movie I like a lot. But it's a lot more focused on just being kinetic and fast moving and very entertaining. Mm. And this is a lot more contemplative. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Coens can do that kind of kinetic style, which they did in Raising Arizona. But they're really slowing it down here, and I think trying their best to do like a more serious, respectful movie. And I think sometimes they're almost trying too hard to make a serious, respectful movie. I like it when they're a little bit looser.
Yeah, you and Jeremy last night were like, I don't know, you guys were like playing around too much during that first Miller's Crossing scene, like when he takes him out into the forest. I was like, no, you guys, seriously, it's like really important. But I know you've seen it before.
Right.
But for me, I felt it was like such an intense scene and you guys were like trying to have
That's a great, super intense scene.
I know, but you two were like, I don't know what you were doing.
I know.
But
maybe it is
being like, be quiet, guys.
Maybe it's because we had seen it before and we were trying to lighten the mood a little bit.
Yeah, you were trying to lighten the mood. It didn't need to be lightened. It was very serious.
Mm-hmm. Roger Ebert did not like this movie.
Wow. Really?
Most people liked it. He said, this doesn't look like a gangster movie. It looks like a commercial intended to look like a gangster movie. Everything is too designed, and that goes for the plot and the dialogue, too.
I'm going to say it's not my favorite, and I feel like so far, me and Mr. Ebert kind of get along on our reviews.
Look, as long as we're saying final thoughts, this is a movie that I really respect, and I love, and I can see that it's a really well-made movie, and I love a lot of the thematic stuff going on, and it's got incredible performances. Mm. It's still not a movie that grabs me the way my favorite films from these guys grab me, for whatever reason.
Right.
It's a little bit chilly, and it's a little bit slow. And I think that's obviously what they're going for.
Yeah.
But it's not so much my speed.
I mean, I like it a lot because it's, I don't know, it's very clear to me what they're trying to, like, and maybe that's a bad thing, that it's simple, that they, like, their themes are simple and it's clear. But, I mean, I do like that a lot. I mean,
that's not a bad thing. I think it's...
What they're going for, I see exactly what they're going for. I see exactly what they're saying. You can't trust any... You don't know anybody as well as you think you do, you know?
Right.
That's...
No, I love that's the thing. I love that thematic mm-hmm. material. I think mm-hmm. that's one of the best parts of this movie is the fact that there is such richness.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still, out of the three that we've watched, I still like Blood Simple the best.
Really?
Yep.
That's crazy. You're
that's
crazy.
No. the reason for that is, I think also because when we watched the director's cut and it was like really tight as we discussed, but I think Miller's Crossing, to me, felt similar to Blood Simple in ways because, as you know, I really like a more like human, intense like reflection of humanity, whatever. So I liked that there were a lot of parts like that in this movie. Like that was a big main part of it. But there were some things lacking for me, like the Verna thing for me was weird. Mm. And mm-hmm. I think it, something about the pacing or intensity was sometimes too low for me. And I don't really need like big attention grabbing stuff, but maybe there was like a couple things that could have been tightened up. Mm. And then I think I would have liked it better, but I still really liked it. But it's not where I'm like, well, like that was really good.
No, particularly the first half hour or so of the movie. I think it took obviously there's a lot of stuff to set up and a lot of dominoes to get together.
But it takes a while to get going. Yeah.
It does take a little while to get going. And I think, I think the Coens a little bit were trying to kind of just tamp down their normal impulses and be like, we are going to slow things down and make things and have lots of long conversations in big tasteful rooms. I think they're working against their instincts a little bit.
Maybe, but what I think might be the problem is, because I think it's kind of nice to have a slow down pace too, especially like just watching Raising Arizona, I was kind of like, this is nice. It's like a normal pace, like things would maybe normally happen like this in real life. But there was something about that slowed down pace that, like, I think the intensity sometimes needed to be picked up somehow. For me, it wasn't really like a length or pacing. It was like the intensity during the pacing. Like, if we're talking about like the duck goose analogy, like the ducks were like not like barely there. You know, like it needed to be like a little bit like some kind of duck, like something that's like adding to it. And it kind of, I don't know, it missed the mark a little bit for me.
I feel
way.
Yeah, and that first scene, I mean, because even though I knew like, they're saying stuff that's going to come back later in that first scene.
Yeah.
It still was, I thought, what's going on? What is going on? What's happening? And that first scene is very like jarring. Like, what's everything that's happening? I wish I knew the background, but now that I know the background, I can watch that first scene.
Yeah, sure. It's certainly a movie. Yeah. Like I said, it's a movie I think that takes multiple viewings to totally appreciate. Because a lot of stuff only makes sense in retrospect.
Like they now, I wish I watched it twice before we did this.
It doesn't have a great introduction. That first scene, you don't instantly know what's happening. You don't instantly know what's going on.
But it's a total Coen Brothers technique to bring you into the story.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do like that.
Yeah,
in Medea's race, you know, you're just in. You don't know exactly who these characters are. You don't understand half the slang they're using, but you're in the world.
But the first moment for me where it was like aha was when Verna was at his apartment and my friend was and so he's talking to Leo. Is that Verna who they're talking about? And he was like, he asked about you, and it was like, oh, there it is. And that's for me when it started. That's when it really went in full gear. Then it was, oh, I understand a thing that's happening. Right. I understand one thing that's happening. Right. And then it's more and more understanding throughout the movie. Yeah.
I don't think I ever really had a huge moment like that in the movie.
Also, I was searching for it. I was searching for it. Because I was I was so concentrated. I was leaning. I'm going to know everything that happened. I'm going to know every single line. Yeah.
I mean, my problem is, and I really don't think this is a big deal, but like as we said, we watched it really late at night.
It's
and
true.
I was really tired. Mm-hmm. And at one point, Josh was like, you need to eat Cheetos so you stay awake. Which really helped me.
It did work, yeah.
Because I love Cheetos, which is so weird. But anyway.
I think you I actually think you only missed the last 5 minutes or so.
Yeah, no, there's. I really don't think I missed that much. I know I didn't, but I also know that I really wasn't in that like highly alert Coen Brothers movie state, which with when you're like, you know, obviously if we do this on as co-hosts on the show, like that's how we watch all these films, right? We're like really following it. Like this is happening and this, then why this and why that. But if you're also like just a viewer, which I considered myself a civilian viewer last night, like I think that's sort of like an interesting contrast too. Like there's so much that you're not going to get.
Totally.
If you're not like, I'm about to watch a Coen Brothers movie and I'm going to watch for this in the opening and make sure it connects. So there's
That's the thing. We were watching it as a text to discuss.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference than going, say, to a movie theater and enjoying some popcorn and sitting down to watch Miller's Crossing. And I could, and in that respect, I could understand why it made $5 billion at the box office.
Oh, yeah. See, good point. This is great. I feel like last night I was, like I said, I was like a civilian watcher last night, which was kind of good to just get like a different impression of their movie. Cause like, as we talk about it today, I'm like, I really want to rewatch it. Cause I really like a lot of this, like these themes, but you're not going to catch it the first time if you're just watching it.
As a civilian viewer, that first scene, you are thinking what's going on this whole time.
Yeah. Seriously.
What's the point of this?
I think both you and Jeremy are like, this is going to be really important later. And I'm like,
So you got to pay attention.
Great.
But that's the thing. When the Coen Brothers want to be pure entertainers, I think they're incredible pure entertainers.
That was like Raising Arizona.
Yeah, and I think their best movies do just hit you on that level of like, wow, if you're just a movie goer going to see this, it's just going to grab you.
Yeah.
And this one doesn't necessarily.
Well, and you know, maybe that's why they have the Danny Boy scene, because I remember watching it the first time. I didn't get a lot of that stuff, but I noticed the Danny Boy scene, and then it's really cool.
It's an awesome movie.
yeah. And
that's actually
So that maybe that's how they try to get normal people, like people that aren't like concentrating, paying
like
attention, analyzing it to really like it too. Where people just want to, you know, just watch and enjoy and don't want to think about it as much.
As we say this right now, I just have to say that actually my appreciation for them just shot up, because I'm actually not a big movie goer, as like people probably noticed by now, since I have not seen any Coen Brothers movies except for the ones. Yeah. So
which is why it's fun to have you as co-host.
Yeah. But so every time I watch it, I'm watching it as like paying attention and analyzing it, whatever. But I actually think like a big reason that I don't even end up watching movies is, for me, I personally just don't get like that much enjoyment out of like going to a movie that's like, and then he shot him up and then he won and then he killed everybody in his house and it's great. Like I'm not really like that into like maybe that form of entertainment, but I've really loved these movies so far because I can see like the Coen Brothers have like a lot of, you know, deep themes and
stuff
that they're doing.
They are making movies about stuff.
Yes.
For sure.
And I love stuff. I love human stuff.
Yeah. Stuff is good.
Yeah. But I really do like that, the more complicated and like nuanced kind of themes and stuff like that. So
I agree. I agree totally. For that, if there's a movie like that, that's just shoot 'em up, I'll just like watch that scene on YouTube or something.
Yeah.
If I'm going to watch a movie, you know, sometimes I do want to mess, and those are going to be my favorite movies. Those are going to be the movies that I would have in my collection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want movies that change my life. That's what I want.
I'm just going to, can I just say, I give this movie 2 thumbs up. I just changed my tune. Like, I just want to say.
It
really hit me, but it also could be that I'm giving the Coen brothers 2 thumbs up. Maybe not necessarily this movie, but like what this movie is doing, this is clicking for me.
Again, so. I often like movies that are not about anything in particular. I keep mentioning Tarantino, but his movies have no deep themes whatsoever. That doesn't mean I don't like him.
But I like Reservoir Dogs. Like, there's several clues as to who the snitch is, the cop. There's some cool thing. Well, I didn't say who it was.
Yeah, no.
I'm just warning you.
There's cool stuff going on in these movies, but arguably that's all they are. It's a whole bunch of cool stuff happening.
Yeah.
Which is the Coen brothers have thematic material, and that's why I like them a little bit more.
It's so funny that movies that you like better after discussing them.
Yeah.
Like, that's part of the movie.
I like that. I really like that. Yeah.
That's cool.
A movie that...
It's still not my favorite Coen Brothers movies, but I now appreciate it much more for what it's doing, because I just see that it's, like, hitting on a different level, and I really like that about it. That's why I always end up just seeing, like, just because, like I said, I don't really go to movies that much, but I'll see, like, random foreign movies that, like, do this same thing, and I'm like, oh, that was amazing. But I just never really go to movies to be, like, sitting there and, like, eating popcorn and chilling out. Like, I guess it's just not for me that fun.
I like a movie that stays with you, and a movie that you keep thinking about. And to me, the best Coen Brothers movies do that, and this is an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to rewatch it.
Awesome.
That's also my moral of the story.
Well, I think that just wraps things up. Any final thoughts on Miller's Crossing?
I've really liked watching it again.
Great.
And I'm going to watch more Coen Brothers movies now, too. I've seen quite a few, but I mean, I haven't seen all of them. I haven't seen Blood Simple or Raising Arizona, so
watch both of those and then take a listen to our podcast after
For sure.
Spoiler alerts.
Yeah. For spoilers.
For spoilers that weren't in the movie that I just saw.
No, I'm just saying, because it will be a spoiler alert if you don't. It will ruin it for you. Like, nobody should listen to these podcasts if they haven't seen the movie, in my opinion.
We have only one segment left. It is time for something we call Raising Arizona. I'm never going to get sick of that pun.
Well, I'm very excited because of that name.
Are you good at quizzes? Like trivia and stuff?
Sometimes.
We're about to find out, because you and Jackie are facing off on a quiz loosely inspired by the movie of the week. And this week, the loose inspiration is hats. We've got 10 questions about hats.
Okay.
You guys are going to answer.
Don't be scared. I keep losing. Okay. Actually, that's not true. I only really lost in the first one, but I'm a really bad loser.
You don't keep losing. You're so far, you're 1-1.
Yeah, but I feel like a loser.
You're one. You're 1 out of 2, so you're... Is that
it's
right?
50%. That's failing. 50%,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I guess that would be an F if I had to grade you.
But nobody gives a test with just 2 answers. That's mean.
Well, Jackie, if you win this one, we might be able to get you up to a D+.
Great.
Or Daryl will steal your thunder. Let's find out. First question about hats.
Oh, wait. Explain how it works, though. When you know the answer, you ding.
Oh, yeah.
Just go ding.
We said that the last couple times, but it turns out not to be necessary, because I just wait for both you guys to answer anyways.
Well, I'm just saying we should...
Okay, fine.
Short answer?
It's multiple choice.
Yeah, but then just say ding when you know the answer. Or just try to say ding.
Okay, and if somebody says ding and gets it wrong, does the other person get a chance to say... Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what's going to happen both you guys are going to answer, and then you guys could either tie or one gets it right or the other.
But I feel like the ding kind of lets you get like the first answer in.
Okay, yes.
All right.
Question number one. The propeller beanie was invented by who? A, a science fiction writer. B, a pilot. C, a vaudeville singer.
Bing?
Bing. We are not sponsored by
Google.
Bing.
Bing. Bing, you can look this up on Bing right now before I answer. I'm going to say A.
Science fiction writer?
Yes.
Jackie?
That was my first instinct. C seems to make more sense. I could tie, lose, or win.
Those are your three options.
choose to win if those are the options.
I'm just going to go with A because I felt like it was the right answer before I heard the other ones, but I could be wrong.
You guys are both right.
I knew
yes.
it!
Yes!
Science fiction writer Ray Faraday Nelson is said to have created the propeller beanie in 1947 for a sci-fi convention. and since then, after that, homemade versions of propeller beanies began popping up, almost like an early way of showing your nerd bona fides in the 40s.
That's so
was
cool.
to wear a propeller beanie.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So nerds look yeah. much different in the 40s.
The early cosplay.
Wow.
Was propeller beanies.
I'm gonna go to Comic-Con or something as a 40s nerd.
You should. Oh, that would be so cool.
Like, yeah, like a classic nerd.
Yeah. Retro nerd.
Question number two. Why are hat makers called milliners? Okay.
There's
yeah.
options. Unless you already know the answer. Dang.
A. The first hat makers were millers who made hats out of straw. Hmm. B. The best hats used to be made in Milan, Italy. C. It's a colloquial form of millionaire because hat makers were very profitable.
Chameleoners.
Yeah, milliner.
Can you say the answers? I thought I knew this for
a,
sure.
A. The first hat makers were millers who made hats out of straw. B. The best hats used to be made in Milan, Italy. C. It's a colloquial form of millionaire because hat makers were very profitable.
Ding. I'm going to go with A on that.
All right. The first hat makers were millers who made hats out of straw. Jackie?
That seems like the most logical answer, but I hate it for some reason, and I'm just going to say B just to see what happens. I don't know.
Jackie gets a point.
Whoa!
Oh! I was like, it's one of those.
All I want to say is, I don't know how to like get right answers on stuff. I just try to go with my intuition.
That's
so
that's the only way to do it.
But so
in
weird.
The 18th century, Milan was known for their high-quality hats, so hat makers were called milliners. Nobody went for me saying it's just a way people used to say millionaire. Milliner.
It just didn't seem likely because how many?
You're a milliner. No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, dad joke alert.
Thank you. Question three: true or false? Pilgrim hats never had buckles on them.
Ding! I'm gonna go with true on that.
It's
Jackie,
true that they never did.
That they never had buckles, unlike the classic depictions where they have buckles on the front.
Now I don't know what my... I can't channel my intuition. I'm going to say B.
False?
Yeah.
Daryl gets a point.
Yes!
Yeah. The buckled pilgrim hat was an image created in the 19th century to mock the pilgrims.
Yeah, it just seems that there's no use for a buckle on your hat.
Yeah, why would you have a buckle on your hat?
Style.
I guess.
Why would you have a ribbon on your hat? Why would you have a feather on your hat?
But buckle is meant to fasten things.
So?
They're settlers, though. Why would they care about style? We're moving somewhere. We're trying to survive. I don't think they care how much they look, really.
How does that mock them?
I think it's because pilgrims were dumb enough to like put like a belt buckle on their head.
I'm not
That was humor in the 19th century.
I could see it too, because
no,
if that was like your waist, then your face would be your butt. So it's like, oh, look at the butt heads.
Exactly.
Butthead. Buckle heads are butt heads.
Yeah.
Question four. The dunce cap was invented by a guy named John Duns Scotus, a Franciscan scholar. It was commonly worn by poor students during the 19th century. What was the original purpose of the dunce cap? A. To make the wearer look like a witch or warlock and cause fear in other school children. B. To make punishments harsher with the heavy hat causing neck strain. C. To focus mental energies and help the child's studies.
Ding. I'm reluctantly saying C.
Okay.
You said it was started by a priest?
A Franciscan scholar.
Oh, scholar.
Scholar.
Oh, boy. I'm going to... What was B?
B was to make the punishments harsher with the heavy hat that causes neck strain.
I'm going to go... I feel like this is going to be bad, but I'm going to go with A.
To make the wearer look like a witch or a warlock?
Yes, I'm doing it.
Jackie gets a point.
Yeah.
Ding.
I knew.
I thought that, by the way. Have you guys seen this thing on Facebook? Like, I feel like a lot of people post it, but it's like that... that thing from, I don't even know what era, but it must have been like the 30s, where it's like a thing to help you concentrate, and it's like this bubble, and it just has like goggles on it, and then it has like air that comes out, so it's like this like chamber that people would wear to like focus and concentrate. And like somebody posted it on one of my friend's walls, and my friend's like, oh my god, I need that. And I was like, I need that too, because I can't concentrate. So it just seems like people were always trying to like stick things on your head or whatever to like focus you. So yeah, just, like I could see. I mean, like dunce cap makes in this you focus.
Yeah, in this case, it was like actually Duns Scotus thought that the wearing like a conical hat would like focus the brain's energies.
Yeah,
and like a cone with a cone shape.
I could see how that would be. Well, something people would think.
I don't know, and I also thought like, oh no, because they were poor kids, maybe they want the other kids to be scared of them.
Or, yeah, no, like, they were poor students.
Oh,
like,
poor student. Oh. Yeah. I lost some because I didn't. Yeah. Well, you got to pay attention to questions is what you got to do.
Question 5. How many beaver pelts did it take to make one of John Stetson's original Stetson hats? A, 3. B, 16. C, 42.
Ding, B.
16?
Yeah.
I would think that too, but I have to get a point where she doesn't get a point.
Yeah,
so.
See, it gets complicated.
Right,
messes
yeah,
with you.
That's the gamesmanship angle.
I hate it too. See, I know. I have to do this every week. It's horrible.
Oh, I know I'm punishing you so badly by doing this.
Josh is so mean to me.
You know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to go with A.
Do it.
3?
You'll be right.
Yes.
You said 3. You said 16?
Yeah, he's right.
The right answer was 42.
What?
What?
Get out!
Yeah. 42 beaver pelts went into the original Stetson hat.
I don't care.
John Stetson considered it necessary to make the hat properly waterproof.
Wow.
Okay. Psychopath. Okay.
Really? I know. It's a lot of beavers. A lot of dead beavers.
Poor beavers.
Question 6. The Phrygian hat, like Phrygian, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but the Phrygian hat, it's now best known as the hat worn by the Smurfs, or Link, you know, one of those kind of, soft pointy hats.
Looks like a Hershey's Kiss.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it has a long history. It was developed in ancient Greece.
What?
Sorry. Yeah. And it was famously worn by King Midas after he had judged a so-called Battle of the Bands between Apollo and Pan. Apollo, who played the lyre, and Pan, who played the flute. And Midas judged Pan the winner, but Apollo was so upset by that, he did something that made Midas wear a Phrygian hat for the rest of his days in shame. What did he do? A. He made his ears fall off. B. He flipped his ears so they faced backwards. C. He changed his ears to donkey ears. Ugh.
I'm going ding. I'm going to go with C.
All right.
Yeah, I'll go with A.
Daryl gets a point.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, the ears of an ass.
It just makes sense because I would think the ears would fit well into that. Keep it kind of up.
Yeah. Kind of tuck them in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Only Midas's barber knew the truth, and he had been sworn to secrecy. But the knowledge got to be more than the gossipy old barber could contain. So he went out into the country and dug a hole somewhere and whispered the secret into the hole and covered it up. But the next spring, reeds and grasses grew on the spot where the barber planted a secret, and the wind whispered through the reeds and told the secret over and over again. And that's why it makes that noise.
Secrets, dude.
Yep.
Wow.
According to legend. 7. What did Pharrell cite as the inspiration for his famous Mountie hat?
I'm so mad right now.
A. An 80s breakdancing video. C. A classic Western movie. C. A German propaganda film.
If it's C, that would be so stupid. What is A and B again?
An 80s breakdancing video. A classic Western movie.
For the Mountie hat?
For the Mountie hat.
Mounties are not classic.
Ding, I'm going to go with B.
Classic Western movie. Jackie?
I hate all of this. I can't believe I don't know this answer. Like,
you really
should know the answer just without even this stupid quiz. Just gonna go with A.
80s breakdancing video?
Yeah.
Jackie gets the point.
Oh, no. I didn't know it, but I'm glad that I knew it.
The hat was designed by Vivienne Westwood, British fashion designer who collaborated with Malcolm McLaren on everything from early punk styles to that hat, which was featured in Malcolm McLaren and the world-famous Supreme Team's Buffalo Gals videos in the early 80s.
Mm. That's interesting. Because classic Westerns don't have Mounties, right?
No.
They have cowboys. Yeah.
But I thought it was just the hat, though.
But Mounties are not, like, Western, right?
No, that hat really doesn't show up in Westerns.
Yeah, but I know, but it's inspiration Maybe yeah, there's a hat.
Your eight is seeing. I get it.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. Question eight. One day. It's okay. Hey, you can catch up. You got room to catch up.
I'm only one behind.
This is the tightest game we've played so far.
Yeah, this is really close game. Yeah.
Yeah, usually I'm like much more pissed throughout the whole thing because I'm like seriously losing or seriously winning.
Or seriously winning. Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
Question eight. One day in 1797, a hatter named John Hetherington walked through London wearing a brand new style of hat. The first time this particular hat had ever been seen in public.
Sorry, what year?
1797. Oh. Chaos quickly ensued. Women fainted. Children screamed. Dogs barked. One small boy even suffered an arm injury for some reason. John Hetherington was charged with disturbing the peace and fined £500. Soon afterwards, the hat was outlawed. What was the hat? A, a fedora. B, a top hat. C, a bearskin hat.
Top hat?
Ding. Okay. What was C again?
A bearskin hat. It's like those hats that the Buckingham Palace guards wear.
I could have messed this up.
You said 1797.
1797.
You know what? I'm gonna take a chance. Go with A.
Fedora.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Jackie gets a point.
Oh man! Now I'm losing.
During the trial, the hat was described in court as a tall structure that had a shiny luster that was calculated to frighten timid people.
That's amazing.
People used to get freaked out by really little things back in the day, like top hats.
Sensitive constitutions.
Yes, they were very sensitive people. You can still tie, Daryl.
Okay.
Two more questions.
Sorry, Daryl.
Hey, it's fine. That's how the games go.
True or false? John F. Kennedy triggered a precipitous decline in men's hat sales when he appeared at his 1961 presidential inauguration hatless.
Ding. I'm going to go with true.
Okay, Jackie?
I'm going to go with true.
You're both wrong. It's false.
What?
It's an urban legend. Because not only did the decline in men's hat sales start long before 1961, JFK actually wore a hat at his inauguration.
That's a trick.
Yep.
You know what? You have to give us the facts in a question. You can't just.
It's a true or false question.
Never
so
mind.
It could be false.
I see. You crossed us.
Last question.
He crossed us.
Double cross.
In this podcast, a bunch of crossing has been happening.
Yep.
Question 10. The most popular baseball cap is the New York Yankees baseball cap, of course. But what is the second most popular baseball cap? Is it A, the Atlanta Braves, B, the Boston Red Sox, C, the Los Angeles Dodgers?
B.
You say Red Sox?
I know she's right. I'm pretty sure she's right, but I'm just going to go with A.
Daryl gets a point.
Yeah!
I don't know why, but it is indeed the Atlanta Braves at the second most popular.
I see those a lot. I see them a lot.
Yeah,
okay.
See, I just wouldn't know. I just know that there's a Red Sox rivalry, so I was like, oh, it has to be that one.
Yeah, turns out it's not for
Good
some reason.
Good job, Daryl.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you're still the champion.
You still are the champion.
Yes. All right, I'm good at quizzes.
You're up to D-plus level, Jackie.
Oh,
let's see if we can get you higher through the remainder of this podcast series.
But also, I mean, that was... you beat me by one. So if we're doing I don't know, like FIFA rules where you get points for how much you win by.
That's true.
I don't know if you'd be a master.
It's like electoral college rules. You just get a point no matter what your score was.
I don't like that though, because I have this like complete insecurity about quizzes, as you probably have noticed. People will notice by now because I'm so competitive.
I actually
like the FIFA rules better.
This is how you can do it. You get positive points when you win, however much you win by, and you get negative points when you lose, however much you lose by. Mm-hmm. And if you're above zero, then you are a winner. If you're below zero,
that can be rough for you. You really lost that first quiz.
I know. Yeah. No, but that fair is fair. Like that would be a much more accurate reflection.
I'll go through the old episodes. I'll calculate up the points. I'll see what your FIFA score is at.
Thank you.
All right. That's wrapping things up. Daryl, you do... I know it's on hiatus, but you do a podcast called The Live Jazz Podcast.
Live Jazz The Comedy Show on iTunes. There's also a website, livejazzthecomedyshow.com. And that's live Jazz, L-I-V-E.
What did people think you were saying?
Live Jazz.
Live Jazz?
I don't know. I was saying it. I noticed when I was saying it fast, and I was like, oh, I might
Live Jazz Coalition.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you thought I was talking like they do in Miller's Crossing when you're saying that they were mumbling a little bit.
Or it could be Live Jazz, like live that's your motto.
At first I did want to call it Live Jazz, but... other people are against it because I think that would be super funny because it looks like live, but it's actually right. Live.
Yeah.
And I also have to say I was disappointed when I walked in and nobody was playing jazz.
Oh, yeah.
There was no jazz.
There was no jazz. Yeah. No, there's no... And it's pre-recorded, too, so...
So it's not live, either.
It's
just a bullshit name, dude.
It is. It's a double crossing. It's a crossing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you crossed us.
I crossed everyone. But there is comedy and it's a show.
That was an awesome show. I had a great time on it. Yeah. Are there anything else you want to plug into the projects you got going on?
Whenever this comes out, I have a sketch team doing sketches. We probably will be doing Sketch Showdown at IO West, so come
nice.
And check that out.
Very cool.
We do, yeah, and we do the open mics, which is Go Sketch Yourself and... at IO West and then at UCB, It's Not Too Shabby. Do those a lot. And I got improv teams. I got East Coast Avengers Below the Law, Fun Size. I think that's it, really. Is that it? Yeah, I guess
yeah,
that's it.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. All you have is a couple sketch teams and a couple improv teams and a podcast? What are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm at Daryl Haynes on Twitter. I got a website, darylhaynes.com. Yeah.
How do you spell Haynes? How do you spell Daryl?
D-A-R-R-E-L.
One L.
H-A-Y-N-E-S.
All right.
See, I'm glad you asked that because I spell them both weird ways. So.
Yep, there's totally different ways.
Mm-hmm. Not like the underwear.
Not like the underwear.
Yeah.
Jackie, anything you want to plug?
As always, you follow Josh on Twitter, you should be following me on Twitter.
You know, if we're going to keep plugging your Twitter, you should tweet more.
Oh, yeah. All right, well, by the time this comes out, I will have probably
I need
more.
To tweet awesome. More, too, so...
It's so hard to tweet, because I'm not that funny. Ugh, okay.
That's not true.
Not on tweets. But, okay, my Twitter, which I will be updating more, is MacQueline.
Awesome. And you can follow me, of course, at Radio TFB on Twitter, and find my stuff at joshrichmond.net. Etc. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all I have to plug. Daryl, thanks for coming by and talking Miller's Crossing and
I had
us.
So much fun.
Yeah, we had so much fun too. Thank you.
I also had so much fun. Mm-hmm. We all had so
we
much fun.
We all had so much fun.
We went deep. I like this one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cool. I was excited to come here because I was like, oh, this is going to get deep.
We did indeed get deep.
I'm glad we did not disappoint on that score.
Yeah.
And all you guys at home, I hope we went deep enough for you. I hope there wasn't any Miller's Crossing stones we left unturned.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we're going to be talking about two different Sam Raimi-associated and Coen-associated films, Crime Wave and Darkman. So that's going to be awesome, our first two for a podcast. So if you're keeping up with the podcast, watch those and then take a listen with us. And we will see you guys next time around.
Bye.
Bye, bye, bye. Bye. Why did I say bye, bye, bye like in NSYNC?
Bye, bye, bye. Make sure you use that.
I will. Bye, bye, bye.